Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
What do you get when you take award-winning plays and transform them into bingeable audio dramas? Play Me from CBC Podcasts brings you contemporary theatre at its best. Listen to hits like Sexual Misconduct of the Middle Classes, Mixtape, Wildfire, Where the Blood Mixes, and Serving Elizabeth, and interviews with acclaimed playwrights.
I'm Laura Mullen. Chris Tolley and I are bringing you a brand new season of Play Me, available now on the CBC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. Play Me, transforming drama for the digital age.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 9th of February, these are our main stories. As anger grows over Turkey's response to the earthquakes that have killed thousands of people, President Erdogan hits out at his critics. President Zelensky of Ukraine flies to Britain and France to ask for fighter jets. The Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, says it's now clear Vladimir Putin was involved in the downing of an airliner over Ukraine 9 years ago. 3 days on from devastating earthquakes, which are now known to have killed more than 12,000 people in Turkey and Syria, Turkey's president has hit back at mounting anger over his state's response. During a visit on Wednesday to one of the hardest hit regions of southern Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan told reporters it was not possible to be prepared for a disaster this big.
Devletin kurumları hepsi iş başında.
All state institutions are working on the earthquake at the moment. On the first day, we experienced some issues. But then on the second day and today, the situation has been taken under control. We shall never allow our citizens to be left out on the streets. I'm asking our people not to give the provocateurs an opportunity and only pay attention to the statements coming from the Disaster Management Authority. Today is a time of unity and solidarity.
Twitter access in Turkey is now reported to be restricted after many people vented their anger on social media that help has either been too slow or not come at all. As well as the freezing cold, the lack of shelter and supplies, there's been a heavy emotional toll. This man said he was struggling to cope since losing the woman he loved.
She was going to be wearing a wedding dress, but is now wearing a funeral shroud. Imagine if somebody tied your hands and your feet and you cannot get up. There's no food, no water, no air. This is how I feel. I am like the walking dead. I am the living dead. I have lost my feelings.
But rescue teams say they are doing their best to try to reach all those trapped under the thousands of buildings that collapsed on Monday. Belit Tashdemir of the Turkish search and rescue organisation, the Akut Association, explained the scale of the challenge.
We're considering the amount, the area that is affected is roughly the, very crudely speaking, the size of England. We try to respond to the sites that we can. So far, our team alone has pulled out nearly 100 victims alive from under the rubble. It is a challenge, not only physically, but also emotionally.
Our correspondent, Anna Foster, is in Marash, which was at the epicentre of the earthquake.
People I've just been talking to next to this collapsed building say that they have real concerns about the children who are now sleeping outside. They say that the children are starting to get high temperatures. And of course, there are no pharmacies open at the moment. There's nowhere to get medicine or the kind of medical help that they need, because, of course, medics are helping the wounded, the people with crush injuries from the earthquake. So it is a real problem. People are feeling abandoned in many ways. They don't have the shelter that they need. They don't have the food or the water that they need. They don't have the warmth that they need. I'm actually standing next to a fire pit that's been built, filled with pieces of burning wood from the collapsed building next to me. There are so many basic things that these survivors don't have.
And they're supposed to be the lucky ones because they're still alive. But every day we're hearing new stories of loss.
That's right. And in buildings like this one, I watched bodies being brought out regularly, one after the other. And every time the reaction from the relatives is hard to comprehend. And in a building like this one, they know, in fact, they're just carrying a body past me now. You can hear the sounds of their feet through the rubble. In fact, they've brought two coffins out of an ambulance, and this body, it's wrapped in a black body bag, and it will be taken to, well, many of the bodies have been taken to a local sports hall and laid out on the ground. But it just shows you that this effort, not a rescue effort, sadly a recovery effort, is continuing around the clock.
And Anna, you're at the epicentre of the earthquake in Marash. Can you just provide for our listeners some insight in how you're managing to cover this story in very difficult, dangerous conditions? How did you get there? Where are you staying, given the fact that most buildings are in danger of collapse there? And how are you, for instance, charging up equipment, things like that?
You're right about the shelter. I mean, these buildings aren't safe for anybody. We are extraordinarily fortunate because we have a car that we can use for shelter. There are small charging points that we can use. It tends to be overnight because in the daytime the real priority is the people here who are in need. So last night we were charging equipment in the middle of the night at one of the charging points that's been set up at the aid village. Obviously using a phone, the signal from which, and again, this is everybody using the same phone signals. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. And in fact, when you travel around the city, it's very unpredictable as to whether you can keep a call going, whether you can send messages, whether you can keep in touch with people. It's really everything that you would expect from a city where the infrastructure, the basic infrastructure, has been completely destroyed in so many places.
Anna Foster in Marash. Well, as well as laying waste to large swathes of southern Turkey, Monday's earthquakes also devastated northwestern Syria, an impoverished, war-shattered region, parts of which are home to the remnants of the opposition that have been fighting Bashar al-Assad's regime for 12 years in a civil war. If Turkey, with its state institutions and pledges of Western aid, is struggling, then in fractured Syria, people feel even more abandoned. In the rebel-held town of Cinderis, one resident said there were more people under the rubble than above it. Turkey now says it's hoping to open two more border crossings into Syria to enable vitally needed aid to get into the country. In Washington, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it was vital additional routes were established to the only one that currently exists, and condemned Russia, a staunch ally of the Syrian government, for its efforts to close this crossing.
There is one crossing that allows assistance to get into Syria from the outside, and that was disrupted by the earthquake. It's exactly why we have been fighting every single year, not only to preserve that crossing, it's authorized, as you know, by the United Nations, but to get additional ones so that if a crossing was taken out of action, there would be other places that people could get humanitarian assistance in. And of course, year after year, Russia has sought to block those crossings or to limit them. And that only compounds the tragedy that people in Syria are now experiencing.
Amma Al-Samu from the Syrian civil defense group known as the White Helmets said he was concerned whether aid sent to regime-held areas would be sent to those controlled by the opposition in the northwest of the country.
Northwest Syria have the aid from Turkey, from UN agencies, that cross-border aid delivered since years. And since years, there is no aid coming from the regime area. Every effort, every aid delivered to the regime control area, surely will not deliver to northwest Syria.
Hisham Shawish from BBC Monitoring is following developments on the Syrian side of the border.
We're hearing reports from activists on the ground, particularly in Idlib province. That's a rebel-held province. So activists there have said that there's no humanitarian aid arriving at all. We've seen the White Helmets report that a technical team from Egypt has arrived. They arrived this morning and they thanked them, but nothing else. So it's a very complicated picture. And what's compounding the situation is the fact that there are no crossings that are open between Turkey and Syria. The only crossing between Syria and Turkey that has been approved by the UN for transporting international aid is the Bab el-Hawa crossing, and that's been really damaged as a result of the earthquakes. And most of the aid that's coming through is now going through Damascus, the international airport there, which is controlled by the government. We saw an aid plane, a relief plane, arrived from Jordan, also at Latakia International Airport. That's closer to the affected area. But again, these are in government-held areas, so it's very difficult to see how the aid is going to be funneled into the areas which are controlled by the rebels and the areas which are also controlled by Turkish-affiliated militias.
Hesham Shawish. The administration of the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, is under Western sanctions because of its treatment of civilians during the civil war. The European Commission says that the Syrian government has requested assistance from the EU. Washington has made it clear that it will not deal directly with the Syrian authorities, but would support work carried out by NGOs in the country. My colleague James Kumarasamy spoke to Bouthina Shaban, a special advisor to the Syrian president al-Assad.
The scale of disaster is huge, actually, and what has made it worse is that we do not have the right equipment. We do not have enough bulldozers, we do not have enough cranes, we do not have enough oil due to European and American sanctions who speak about not preventing humanitarian aid. But when you have people trapped under the rubbles, the bulldozer and the crane became extremely humanitarian tools in order to get these people out.
You have applied directly to the European Union for aid, haven't you? What sort of response have you had?
The European Union and the United States, what they need to do is to lift these sanctions, to allow countries who want to send us aid to be able to send us aid without any punishment for these countries. We did not receive anything from Europe and the US. While they sent rescuers, they sent dogs, they sent machines to Turkey. The people who are trapped under the rebels in Syria are human beings like the people who are trapped in Turkey. We would like them to treat us like Turkey.
I understand, but the European Union, the United States are absolutely clear that aid, humanitarian aid, is not subject to sanctions as long as it's distributed through internationally recognized non-governmental organizations working in Syria. You can have aid, can't you?
There are many non-governmental organizations, UN organizations, are working within Syria. We did not have any assistance which we refused from anywhere.
No, but the European Union has said it is considering, it is not rejecting Syria's call for aid. Individual member states are considering it now.
They are considering, but the people under the rebels do not have time. They are dying, and we are only taking people who are dead. This should happen in the first moment.
A lot of the area that is affected, of course, is not under Syrian government control, and there are logistical problems there. Are you in touch with Turkey about making sure that there are ways for aid to get into those areas in the north?
Listen, first, what they are saying is not true. Latakia and Aleppo are the worst hit countries under government control, while what the Europeans want is only to send aid to the White Helmets and to the terrorists in the northwest of Syria. We are not in touch with Turkey because Turkey is occupying part of our land.
Bouthina Shaban, a special advisor to the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad. The Ukrainian leader has flown into France hours after visiting Britain, where he addressed a joint session of parliament calling for fighter jets to defend his country against the Russians.
And I appeal to you and the world with simple and yet most important words. Combat aircrafts for Ukraine. Wings for freedom. Years ago, I thanked you for delicious English tea. And I will be leaving the parliament today, thanking all of you in advance for powerful English planes.
In response, Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said nothing was off the table when it came to military support for Ukraine, including fighter jets. In Paris, Volodymyr Zelensky held a joint news conference alongside his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron and the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Both leaders reaffirmed their support for Ukraine. Mr. Zelensky is expected to go on to Brussels on Thursday for an EU summit, and Mr. Scholz had this encouraging message for him.
I travel to Brussels with a clear message. Ukraine is part of the European family. In June 2022, we set a very important milestone when Ukraine and Moldova became EU accession candidates.
So, amid all the positive words, how much concrete support did Mr. Zelensky get? I asked Vitaly Shevchenko from BBC Monitoring and a Ukrainian himself.
There are practical reasons for him to visit London at this time. And there are also symbolic reasons why he would want to be here. And the symbolism of his trip is particularly important for Ukrainians because Britain occupies a special part in their hearts because it's seen as one of the two best friends Ukraine has at the moment, together with the United States. In practical terms, of course, he's here to thank Britain for the support given to Ukraine so far, but perhaps more importantly, to ask for more. First it was missiles, then it was military fighting vehicles, armoured fighting vehicles, then it was main battle tanks, and now it's about fighter jets. It doesn't look to me that he got what he had been hoping to get. Of course, Prime Minister Sunak said that nothing's off the table and Britain's going to be training Ukrainian military pilots. But the British Prime Minister was really keen to avoid giving any deadlines or timings or numbers, or even he didn't want to commit to promising fighter jets to Ukraine.
What are the Western concerns about fighter jets? And if Ukraine was to eventually get them, what difference would those fighter jets make?
All this time, Western nations have been really careful not to provoke another escalation on the part of Russia. And we've heard numerous voices in the West saying that World War III or nuclear war is the last thing we want. And that's why there's been a very gradual approach to supplying weapons to Ukraine. And Russia has been instrumental, for its part, playing on these concerns or fears. For example, today, the Russian embassy in London said that this might lead to consequences for the whole world, and it warned of a bloody harvest and more escalation.
Vitaly Shevchenko. The Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte, says he's bitterly disappointed that an inquiry has ended into the downing of an airliner over eastern Ukraine 9 years ago. Nearly 300 people, most of them Dutch, were killed when a Russian-made missile struck Malaysia Airlines flight MH17. International investigators say there isn't enough evidence to bring more prosecutions, but they say it's highly likely that President Vladimir Putin personally decided to supply the missile to Moscow-backed separatists in Ukraine. Mr. Rutte agreed.
It's now duidelijk dat hij betrokken is.
It's now clear that he is involved in what happened in the Donbass, and Russia is involved in the deployment of weapon systems. It's clear now that evidence is here, and it fits the pattern of a man and a country that were both concerned only with trying to slow things down, spread falsehoods, injustice, and, of course, a terrible form of aggression since the war in Ukraine.
Our correspondent, Anna Holligan, has more on the inquiry into the downing of flight MH17 and sent this report from The Hague.
Investigators say this recorded call is between Russian officials and separatist forces in Ukraine. In it, a Kremlin aide says there is only one who makes a decision, and also refers to the person who is currently at a summit in France. Dutch prosecutors showed a photograph of President Putin at the time, standing alongside other world leaders at a D-Day commemoration in France. This constitutes the most compelling evidence to date that Mr. Putin gave the order to supply the missile that hit flight MH17. Piet Ploeg lost three members of his family in the attack on the aircraft.
The news about the personal involvement of Vladimir Putin, that was a real bomb, I must say. That was very, very special to hear, and we always thought so, but now we had the proof.
The emergence of this evidence, though significant, is not concrete enough to secure convictions. And as all leads outside Russia have been exhausted, the investigation is being suspended. But the deputy prosecutor, Digna van Boetselaar, told me that could change.
The MH17 phone is still open for witnesses. Our website is still open. And once there's somebody who wants to tell the story or circumstances change, we will be there again and pick it up from there.
The Kremlin continues to deny any involvement, and as head of state, President Putin currently enjoys immunity. However, this evidence could assist prosecutors in ongoing investigations into the Russian state's alleged role in the catastrophe.
Anna Holligan. Now, to most of us, the principle behind quantum computers could seem magical or even just plain old unbelievable. The ability for something to exist in two places at the same time, which would make these machines far more powerful than even the most advanced supercomputers today. But before they become a reality, a few things need to be sorted out, and one of them, it seems, has just been resolved. My colleague Nick Miles heard more from our science correspondent Pallab Ghosh, who began by telling him how quantum computers would work in theory.
Current computers are fantastic, but they work in what computer scientists call a linear fashion, which is solving one calculation at a time. They do this at super fast speeds. Now, the idea of quantum computers is to be able to solve lots of calculations all at the same time. And that they do that by harnessing the weird properties of subatomic particles. So this is being in two places at the same time. And there's another weird property that they try and exploit, which is that particles can be connected to each other, even though they're millions of miles apart, even at opposite ends of the universe. If one moves a little bit, the other mirrors that action instantaneously. Now, by making use of both these properties, the idea is for quantum computers to be able to do lots of calculations all at the same time. And the long and the short of it is, what this means is that they'll be able to do in hours and days what current computers would spend hundreds of years, thousands of years doing, or not able to do at all.
So that's great in theory. Until now, there's been sticking points, one of which seems to have been resolved. But what's happened?
All this is theoretical because one of the problems is that it's impossible to send information from one chip in a quantum computer to another, which makes it very limiting. Now, that's the breakthrough at the University of Sussex. The researchers have been able to do this accurately at record speeds. So that's overcome one of the main roadblocks to having quantum computers. What they hope to do now is to connect lots of chips together and so make a more powerful quantum computer.
Bringing quantum computers online is going to be incredibly important, particularly now, isn't it?
There's much talk about having better security, but the real problem is that quantum computers, once developed, as they will do in the coming years, will be able to crack even the most toughest of encryption we have now. So there's a real arms race between the banks and the finance houses and the security services that want to keep the information they have safe and the people that want to get that information first. So it's not so much a matter of having better security, but having better security quickly enough before the bad guys develop the quantum computers first and crack the codes.
Pallab Ghosh. Still to come.
Basil.
The much-loved British comedy Fawlty Towers is set to return four decades on, with John Cleese once again in the starring role. The United Nations has warned that famine in Somalia is now a strong possibility from April, as current weather forecasts indicate that the country might experience a sixth consecutive failed rainy season. During the launch of this year's humanitarian plan, which needs billions of dollars in funding, the UN said that more than 7 million people continue to be affected by Somalia's longest and most severe drought. Here's our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
This is really a very strong warning from the United Nations and Somalia's humanitarian partners, as well as the Somali government. they're really saying that it's likely that the coming rainy season is not going to produce a lot of rain. That's according to the forecasts, adding to what is already the longest and most severe drought for decades in the country. And so whilst famine was averted last year, the UN is now saying that it's quite likely that they may have to declare a famine by April unless there's a very, very significant response. We're talking about an appeal for over $2.5 billion to help more than 7.5 million people. That's not far off half the population of Somalia. For many months now, we've seen huge numbers of people leaving the rural areas and heading to the urban centres, really changing the way of life for many people in Somalia. 1.4 million have been displaced and 3.5 million livestock have died. So that basically means people cannot continue living in the rural areas. That's why they've had to move to the urban centres. The impact of the lack of food is probably felt most amongst the young, and there have been huge numbers of children dying because their immune systems have been weakened so much. They're dying from diseases like measles. And of course, conflict complicates the whole picture. There are still large areas of the country under the control of Islamist militants, so getting aid there is fraught with problems, and many people have fled those areas because the aid wasn't getting in.
Will Ross, the technology giant Microsoft has been dealt a blow in its attempt to buy the video games firm Activision Blizzard. Regulators here in Britain say they're provisionally opposed to the nearly $70 billion merger. Activision Blizzard is behind some of the world's best-known games titles, from Candy Crush to Call of Duty. The authorities in Britain, the United States and the European Union need to agree to the purchase. Our tech editor Zoe Kleinman has more.
Microsoft has been buying up video game companies for quite some time, but this proposed deal is the biggest in gaming history, and Microsoft's rivals, notably Sony and Nintendo, are fiercely opposed to their competitor hoovering up ownership of this enormous gaming powerhouse. Sony owns the PlayStation console, and one of its fears is that Microsoft could decide to block access to Call of Duty, making it available only on its own console, the Xbox.
These things take planning and preparation. These things take violence and timing. I can do both.
Microsoft says it would not restrict the game for at least 10 years. Some countries have already approved the deal, but the Markets Authority here in the UK says it believes the merger could lead to higher prices, fewer choices and less innovation for UK gamers. Microsoft said it was committed to offering effective and easily enforceable solutions to ease the CMA's concerns.
Zoe Kleinman. Now to a pioneering project in the Scottish city of Glasgow. Alcoholics are being given alcohol to try to improve their health. The managed alcohol programme is based on a Canadian scheme. Instead of encouraging abstinence, it offers homeless alcoholics a place in a residential unit where they're given a drink every 2 hours, known as the pour. BBC Scotland's social affairs correspondent Lucy Adams reports.
At the managed alcohol programme in Glasgow's East End, the residents are regularly given wine and beer. The aim is to keep sufficient alcohol in their bloodstream to prevent a seizure and curb cravings, but not enough to get them drunk. In addition, they get a home, stability and structure, the chance to engage with mental health services and develop interests, including music and bowling. Each resident has their own shelf, inner fridge in a locked room with beer and wine bought with their own benefits money. Some critics have argued abstinence is a better way to treat addiction, but the project manager, Peter McLachlan, says they've seen a significant reduction in the demand on emergency services.
The 10 guys and they were reporting estimated that there were, in the last year, between the 10 of them, there was 85 admissions to A&E. We've had 8, there was an estimated 69 arrests for, you know, antisocial behaviour, street drinking. We've only had 3 since the guys moved in here. So you can see that the differences there in terms of the burden on public health services.
There is already interest in the project from other parts of the UK and abroad. If deemed a success, it is likely to be replicated elsewhere.
Lucy Adams. And finally, it's considered to be one of Britain's, if not the world's, greatest comedies. The 1970s series Fawlty Towers has delighted generations for its depiction of a snobbish and angry hotel owner who manages to fall out with most of his guests. But for decades, its star and creator, John Cleese, insisted he would never make another episode of a show that many consider to be comedy perfection. Now, though, even though he's in his 80s, it appears he's had a change of heart. With the details, here's Rebecca Wood.
Waldorf salad, Basil the rat, car thrashing and a moose head. Just some of the moments that Basil Fawlty, played by John Cleese, is best known for.
I am the owner of Fawlty Towers, and may I welcome your war? Your war? You war? You war? You war? And hope that your stay will be a happy one.
The series followed the highly stressed hotelier and his wife Sybil as they tried to keep their English seaside hotel and marriage afloat. The original, written by Cleese and Connie Booth, ran on the BBC in the 70s, and only 12 half-hour episodes exist. But it's considered a comedy masterpiece, which is perhaps why many are saying the idea of a remake is risky. In fact, a couple of years ago, John Cleese himself said he doubted if bringing it back was even possible.
The main problem would be the way in which society's changed. I mean, the thing would be completely different if everyone had cell phones. You couldn't even do it anymore. You'd have to utterly rewrite it. And what I like about it is it's slightly old-fashioned.
Perhaps in its favour, the planned sequel will still be written by Cleese, this time along with his daughter Camilla. And it will be made by the US studio Castle Rock, which is behind programmes like Seinfeld. But the original is very much of its age, with some jokes that modern audiences quite rightly find unappealing. William Gallagher is deputy chair of the Writers Guild of Great Britain. He says the comedy landscape is very different now.
An 83-year-old bully, could he work? It could be. Let's see what they do. I hope that one of the things they do is they address the differences. There has been a show on Disney Plus called Reboot, an American series, which is about a fictitious revival of a failed 80s sitcom. And the comedy in it is about how comedy has changed. Some of the cast get it, some don't. And there's also things like some of the cast desperate for work and others aren't. I don't think John Cleese needs to come back for it, but I think it's going to be a good vehicle for his daughter.
Well, his daughter, Camilla Cleese, will play Basil's long-lost child, and they'll team up to run a boutique hotel, no doubt with the cynical and sarcastic Basil struggling to navigate the modern world.
Well, how are we supposed to know that wasn't the fire bell?
Because it doesn't sound like the fire bell.
It didn't.
It did. No, it didn't. A fire bell is a different... It's a semitone higher.
It's not yet clear when it will be happening or which channel or streaming service it would appear on. But maybe it will be one of the lucky ones and join the likes of Frasier or The American Office. Reboot success stories.
I think quite a lot of people will be tuning in to see that. That was Rebecca Wood reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Mike Adley. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
What do you get when you take award-winning plays and transform them into bingeable audio dramas? Play Me from CBC Podcasts brings you contemporary theater at its best. Listen to hits like Sexual Misconduct of the Middle Classes, Mixtape, Wildfire, Where the Blood Mixes, and Serving Elizabeth, and interviews with acclaimed playwrights.
I'm Laura Mullen. Chris Tolley and I are bringing you a brand new season of Play Me, available now on the CBC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. Play Me, transforming drama for the digital age.